Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Hi, Wycombe. Are you in High Wycombe right now? The sort of question you have to ask yourself if you're in High Wycombe. Do you know what High Wycombe is? Get yourself a ticket for the Football Ramble tonight, Saturday the 19th. We're going to be down there having a load of fun. That's ramblelive.com.
E qui siamo all'eliminazione del Bayern contro l'Aberdeen.
Mrs. Thatcher is on her way home from the Falklands after a visit to HMS Antwerp.
E siamo a 2-1 per il Bayern.
A Russian from the International Wheat Organization is expelled from Britain as a spy.
Punizione e il colpo di testa vincente di McLeish ed è 2-2.
And the explorer who's training for the North Pole in a Surrey refrigerator.
L'Aberdeen, per passare il turno, deve assolutamente vincere. Ci riesce con you.
Hello everyone, welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller, Jonathan Wilson is of course opposite me. And on today's show we have Johnny Northcroft, Sunday Times football correspondent and author of Fearless, the amazing underdog story of Leicester City, and also author of Deadlines, Darts and Delhi, World Cup diary, focusing on England's rebirth at Russia and other unexpected tales. And also, Johnny, I will say this about you, you're a fine centre-half as well.
Oh. Thank you very much.
It's lovely to have you on the show, my good man. Thank you very much.
What an intro.
Today's game, you've gone for the 1982-83 European Cup Winners' Cup quarterfinal between Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen and the mighty Bayern Munich. Why, Johnny, have you gone for this game?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's for me, it's just the game that probably stands above anything in my life without getting too in football
in terms good, of good to clarify.
Just in case my wife's watching, probably in life actually. It's got so much from a personal sort of professional and just football point of view. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, the greatest experience I've ever had watching football. I was 12 years old. I was there with my dad, and I think anyone that was at the ground, any Aberdeen supporter, will talk about that. Even above the Cup Winners' Cup final, which came a few weeks later against Real Madrid, that is the iconic game for any Aberdeen fan to have been at. But it's also a game that sort of stayed with me throughout my sort of life, really, I suppose, because one of my big breaks, I guess, in journalism came waiting for when Saturday comes. The first piece I wrote for them was a piece about Aberdeen versus Bayern Munich. The first piece I wrote for the national edition of Sunday Times was, again, rehashing the same old stories that I'm going to rehash again now. And that was in 99 when Man United played Bayern in the European Cup final, and I was Scottish correspondent and suggested, you know, you might want a piece about the first time Alex Ferguson played Bayern Munich. So it's been really important to me. And then also sort of on a family note, I got home from that game with my dad, and we learned that my granddad had passed away. So it's a, you know, there's a lot bound up with that game. But even if none of the personal and professional stuff was there, it you know, the greatest sort of 15 to 20 minutes of my life.
Amazing. And it was subjectively a great game.
It was.
It was great goals, great moments and so on, and a great comeback ultimately from Aberdeen.
And a fantastic second leg of a you know, classic European knockout tie where, you know, 0-0 in the first leg, Aberdeen go to Munich, get a result that's felt to be way above their capabilities, and then everything's poised with the away goals rule at Pittodrie, and just a game that, you know, seesaws back and forwards. Aberdeen didn't actually lead the tie until 13 minutes from time, and I think those victories where you just come from almost nowhere and steal them, there's a sweetness to that, especially when you're stealing them from, you know, sort of German aristocrats like Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, Paul Breitner and so on. Magnificent.
What was the mood like in Aberdeen? Alex Ferguson, of course, is in charge. Aberdeen are having a great time, one of the best periods in their history.
Yeah,
you would say. So the city, in terms of football, must have been a very enjoyable place to be.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about an incredible time generally for the city, because it was the height of the oil boom as well. So there was a sense that this little, you know, Scottish city had really found itself almost at the centre of the world briefly. You know, money was pouring in, property was booming, jobs everywhere. Aberdeen was suddenly in the news, and Alex Ferguson arrived in 79, and just, you know, caught the wave of that perfectly. I mean, we didn't know it at the time, but we were acquiring, you know, possibly the greatest manager in history. But what we did know at the time was, from the moment he turned up, and Aberdeen had had good managers before, had Billy McNeil and Ali McLeod and Jimmy Bonthron, we'd had good managers, but there was something different and combative and special and sort of crusading about this guy. And at the time of 1982-3, you know, looking back, he was only 42. He was kind of Frank Lampard's age. He was a very young man, you know, at the time. He didn't seem that. I guess managers just generally seemed older, but he still had so much of his career ahead of him. And yet it was such a pinnacle at such an early stage. And, you know, Aberdeen had come from being the third or the fourth force in Scotland, won the league under Fergie in 1979-80. In classic Ferguson style, the minute they won the league, first Scottish championship for 25 years, he immediately berated his players for being one trophy wonders.
Yeah.
Then, you know, Celtic were very good at the time, Dundee United were good, Rangers weren't so good, but we went through a period of really competing hard for the titles.
Well, Dundee United in the 80s were excellent.
Fabulous team.
Yeah.
You know, and at that point, Dundee United had their own European history and were beating Barcelona and arguably could have won the European Cup in that time. But in that period, you know, Aberdeen were sort of fighting to become the top team in Scotland, which they did after 1983, really. And, you know, convincingly, the 3 years after that just dominated Scottish football. But in Europe, that was where Aberdeen, you got these glimpses of perspective. You know, you knew you had the special team in domestic terms, but you know, Aberdeen played Liverpool in 1980 and were given a football lesson, given an absolute lesson in European football, in, you know, smart football, just that extra level of mentality and quality. And then...
Do you think that underpinned Fergie's attitude to Liverpool later?
Undoubtedly, because when he went down to Anfield to scout Liverpool, he felt he was really patronised. He sat next to Bill Shankly in the stand, and Shankly apparently said to him, "Ah, you've come to watch our team. They all try that, son." And he went away feeling, you know,
was that his Brian Clough, you know, when Don Revie's Leeds came to town? Was that his moment, do you think, with Liverpool?
Something like, yeah.
He just strikes me as a man who doesn't forget, folks.
He can bear a grudge, yeah.
And yet Shankly by then was absolutely not part of Liverpool hierarchy. So.
No, that's why he was an outsider hanging about with the opposition manager, I guess, exactly. And
that was probably his job, though, was to sledge the opposition, which apparently, with differing results, of course. Ultimately.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and there was bad blood in that tie, actually, because, you know, Liverpool thumped Aberdeen in the second leg 4-0, but in the first leg, it was much more poised. It was at Pittodrie, and I can forget which Kennedy, one of the Kennedys, I think it was Ray Kennedy, broke John McMaster's leg. John McMaster, who we'll talk about in the Bayern Munich game, a fabulous talent and had just got into the Scotland squad. And, you know, he was, before Strachan, he was our proper playmaker. And this was a brutal tackle and it created a lingering sort of bad feeling. So that probably is where it came from with Fergie in Liverpool. So
I think it's worth saying, what you were mentioning about Europe sort of giving you a glimpse of perspective. Mm. Some Cup Winners' Cups, you sort of, they almost feel a bit cheap, feel like a bit of a freebie. This one, it looks like a...
Oh, yeah.
Like a Champions League last eight makeup. I mean, Tottenham had already gone out. You know, very good Tottenham side of Archibald and Hoddle and Garth Crooks had already gone out to Bayern. And then you look at those quarterfinals. You got Bayern Aberdeen. You got PSG were beaten by Vatasai, Genk, as we would now know them from Belgium. A good Austria-Vienna side who put out Barca on away goals. And then Inter and Real Madrid in the fourth game. It's an astonishing quality in that last eight.
No, it's mental. And I mean, I guess it was an accident of what was happening, but Real Sociedad had won the La Liga. Mm-hmm. So you had Real Madrid and Barcelona in the Cup Winners' Cup. Barcelona were the holders. They had Maradona. They'd won in front of 100,000 the year before. You know, it was a serious trophy for them. Then you had Bayern Munich because they'd been in the European Cup final eight or nine months before, lost it to Aston Villa, and had got pipped in the league, I think, by Hamburg. So they, you know, they weren't in as well. And then Juventus were, you know, Italy's top team, but Inter weren't far behind. They had a lot of the World Cup winning squad from 82. And it's hard now to kind of tell people that the Cup Winners' Cup counted, but it definitely at the time felt like it was, you know, the slightly younger brother of the European Cup, but
yeah,
definitely
I think
middle brother.
On average, you'd say the UEFA Cup tended to be higher quality, but this particular year, the Cup Winners' Cup is extraordinary. Because, I mean, like, let's not forget that Hamburg winning the league wasn't a freakish thing. They went on and won the European Cup this year. Mm. So it wasn't that Bayern had sort of lost out to some minnow. They'd lost out to a really, really good side with Kevin Keegan.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember that in those days, it was only the best team from each country that went into the European Cup, because people often think of these other trophies. Well, nowadays in the Europa League, it's sort of the fifth and sixth best teams around some of the leagues. No. It was only the top one who went into the European Cup, of course, in those days. So you are playing against the second best and the third best, potentially, of course, had they've won the Cup.
And another thing for Aberdeen, I mean, we had to play a preliminary round in that. And it was something like mid-August when...
Yeah.
Aberdeen should have still been kind of pre-season training. Played the Swiss champion Sion.
Put them to the sword, though.
Well, yes.
11-1 on aggregate.
Didn't forget that in Bayern. Never have done. No, I mean, but that was it. That was, you know, beat Sion 11-1, and that was the first sort of glimpse that maybe this European campaign is going to be a little bit different, because Aberdeen had come up short before. But then second game was Dinamo Tirana, where there was all the challenges of going to Albania, which, you know, with the dictatorship at the time, they wouldn't allow Fergie to actually go to Albania and scout scouted around at all. He knew nothing about them. The match programme for the home leg, there was just a big blank space where the opposition squad should have been. Nobody knew who was in their team, and they were pretty decent.
None of your players had beards, did they?
No.
Because that had obviously been an issue with Danny McGrain. Was that before that, the Danny McGrain incident, when Danny McGrain had beards had been banned in Albania, and Danny McGrain had to get special dispensation to go in as a Celtic captain, he would have been.
Yeah.
Right.
To be allowed to have a beard in Albania.
Amazing. Yeah, how different it was back then. Well, they come through that tie, only 1-0 on aggregate,
yeah.
Which shows you that Dinamo Tirana were a decent side.
They were very good, very tight, and you know, the away leg was trying to hold that 1-0 home advantage. It was, you know, usually, I think only 20 to 25 Aberdeen people were allowed to actually travel, so they had to leave some club officials behind. You know, it was heat. It was you know, the players came back with all these stories about hotels and food and all that kind of stuff. So that in itself felt like a huge sort of mission had been achieved. And
well, it really was going into the unknown.
Completely.
You know, I mean, to be honest with you, I think if a side went and played in Albania now, you wouldn't know that much about it.
No.
But you could find out some stuff. Back in those days, as you say, especially with a dictatorship, you are going into the unknown completely.
Literally. I mean, Ferguson said later that he'd never played a game in his career where he knew so little about the opposition.
Right.
And it was just a case of focusing on what Aberdeen could do and hoping it would be enough.
So presumably at half-time and it was nil, and he didn't walk in the dressing room and go, lads, it's Dinamo Tirana.
Possibly not.
Well, in the next round, they play Lech Poznan.
Yeah.
We don't know if they were doing that celebration back then, but came through 3-0 on aggregate, so a little bit more straightforward.
Yeah, and things, you know, in hindsight, Aberdeen were starting to build something because, as I say, the early part of Fergie's reign had been couple of European peaks, like beating Ipswich when they were UEFA Cup holders, beating them well actually, and thinking, oh, you know, Aberdeen are going to arrive in Europe, and then being disappointed. But by the time of the Lech Poznan game, I think Aberdeen had gone something like 10, 11 games under Fergie in Europe and only lost one. So the form was starting to build. There were a lot of clean sheets in there. They were starting to get to grips tactically with what to do in Europe. You know, you could see Fergie was changing the kind of gung-ho approach and playing a much more sort of midfield-heavy tactical game. So that's all in hindsight. At the time, as a kid, you know, weren't really aware of that. But looking back, there was definitely a build of sort of form towards the during that campaign, of course, which continued with Bayern and beyond.
Absolutely. All right, after the break, we're going to talk more about Aberdeen's 1982-83 Cup Winners' Cup campaign.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ramble.
Welcome back to Greatest Games, everybody. Now, let's get down to business. Mm. The game itself. So Aberdeen go into that tie. They've only conceded one goal in the competition thus far. And you talk about, you know, Ferguson drilling his players how to play in Europe. Obviously, a different approach to Scotland. You mentioned before, they go away to Bayern. They draw 0-0. And how was that result received? Because a 0-0 can still divide opinion now. People think that's not a bad result. You set it up. Or does it favour the away side in the second leg?
There was a feeling of huge achievement, actually, from that 0-0, as if maybe that's going to be as far as this goes. But Fergie, the classic set of mind games throughout that whole tie, and it started with the away leg, where the interviews that he gave pre-match were things like, oh, we'd be happy just to get beaten 2-0, you know, that'd be a good result. Nothing of the sort was in his mind. And then there's an amazing story where when they went to the Olympic Stadium the night before for that training session, before the match, Archie Knox usually took the sort of pre-match stuff. And just as he was about to start a session, Fergie strode across, you know, ordered Archie to the side of the pitch. So immediately, Archie was a pretty fiery character. He stomped off in a huff. And Fergie organised this ludicrous routine where he put a set of players in the centre circle, and he had four groups, one at each corner flag, and he told them to just ping long balls at the guys in the centre circle. And then, you know, the guys in the centre circle then had to sprint to the corners and then ping long balls into the ones that arrived. People were getting hit in the head and the face. And of course, it was all to make Aberdeen look really bad. The German press were watching, the Bayern people were watching. They thought this was just some comical Scottish team.
It was Aberdeen's first European, it was the first time they'd been in Europe after Christmas, wasn't it? So
yeah,
it was uncharted territory.
It was, and you know, it was the first time since that Liverpool game we'd really played one of the aristocrats of Europe. So there was a lot unknown in it. But Fergie had this, you know, amazing confidence, I guess, because, you know, secretly he thought he was well capable of getting a result. Got his tactics spot on. You know, his big worry was Rummenigge, who was such a great player at the time, twice European Footballer of the Year. But he had Willie Miller, and Willie Miller was, you know, to my dying day, I'll insist, was the Scottish Baresi, and that's a compliment to Baresi rather than. And Willie was put on Rummenigge, which was the key thing in the match, and they had an incredible battle. Rummenigge at one point tried an overhead kick, knocked Willie Miller's teeth out. Rummenigge, actually being a gent, helped Willie find his teeth in the goal mouth. They shook hands at the end, a sort of draw between them, but Aberdeen had nullified Bayern's biggest threat. And then, at odds with that ludicrous training setup that he had beforehand, what you saw from Aberdeen was a really well-structured, tactically mature performance where they, you know, they kept possession, they killed the game. They probably could have won it 1-0. I mean, back home as a kid, these games weren't on TV. You know, I remember listening to that whole game on the radio at my mum and dad's sort of dining table, and that's how you had to consume it in those days. So I think Aberdeen played pretty well, but really I've only got Radio Scotland to tell me.
So how was it treated from Bayern's point of view? Did Bayern think, what on earth was that? Or, oh, that's a sort of a minor stumbling block, we'll have to put them away in the second leg?
Yeah, Bayern respected Aberdeen after that. I mean, Uli Hoeneß, who was the general manager at the time, said, look, I said before the match how good this lot were. Nobody in Germany listened to me. You know, Hoeneß had apparently said Aberdeen were going to be a tougher opponent than drawing Real Madrid or Barca would have been. So there was a respect, but there was also a feeling from Bayern that they had an extra gear. They had a couple of extra gears. They were such a good team. They had such pedigree that they would finish the job in Aberdeen. And of course, as you say, 0-0 can actually be a reasonable result for the away team as well going into the second leg.
Yeah.
So that's the second leg. Let's go through it. It's a 10 minutes in. Brighton takes a free kick short. Argüntala strides forward, takes it past. Who is it? He goes past. Well,
he goes past two or three. I mean, he sidesteps.
It's a little sidestep to his right, and then I think it's Black. He goes past, isn't it? And then absolutely pings on the top corner from 25 yards. I mean, brilliant shot.
But that's the extra gear you're talking about. Yeah. And so early on in the game, that's the moment. You see Aberdeen, a bit of fanfare. You think, blimey, we've gone away to Bayern and 0-0. And then so early in the game, they do that and you go, oh, yeah.
And suddenly they lead too.
Yeah.
They're good, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, yeah. and Aberdeen's, I mean, Pittodrie's a funny old stadium, always has been, but capable of, you know, there's this thing that the old firm would always say you can hear the rustle of sweetie papers in the stands at Aberdeen, because it can be a very quiet ground. I think Aberdonians don't give their emotions away lightly, and from a football perspective, that means the team has to be doing something pretty decent to get people fired up. So I remember just that goal going in and it just killing, killing the atmosphere.
You almost think the goal's been disallowed, like the referee's blown the whistle before.
Yeah.
And even the indomitable Jock Brown on commentary, he's almost sort of stunned slightly himself when that goal goes in. And the way he commentates throughout the game, actually, at various points, it's kind of like, well, there you go. I mean, yeah, inevitable, I suppose, really. The game's gone. See what Aberdeen can do, but yeah, you can't argue with that. That's the kind of tone, isn't it?
That was it. But I mean, to be fair to him, that was the feeling.
Yeah.
Even as a blinkered kid watching my own team, you knew on a football level, this team is actually too good for us technically. Mm. And they were much better than Aberdeen technically.
Yeah, there's something about the aesthetic of that goal as well. I mean, something about the whole night, that the fact the two kits are sort of mirror images of each other. Yeah.
It's kind of classic Adidas.
Well, they're both Adidas. Yeah. No sponsors. So Aberdeen plain red with the three white stripes, Bayern plain white with the three red stripes. Mm. And it's, I don't know, Argentina just looks, I don't know, there's just something incredibly elegant about him.
Yeah, it is.
Even his sort of ridiculous little German early 80s mullet somehow looks good on him. And that shot, I mean, I don't know, something about the way Jim Leighton dives for it is very of its era. Yeah, his build is very much early 80s goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his dive, I guess, is the diver you make if that's your build.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not quite getting there.
Uh-huh.
It's a muddy pitch as well, isn't it? That adds to the...
Yeah, it's just muddy enough. It's not a farce, no. But it's definitely of the early 80s.
Yeah, and Augenthaler, I mean, on the night, he seemed to be, of all of them, the very best. And just even to get the ball out of his feet on that muddy pitch and shift it and put it in the top corners, and incredible technique, and just not something you ever saw in the Scottish League.
But there was a lot more to come in the game.
I mean, Aberdeen started to get back into the short corner, Kennedy's cross, McLeish heads against the bar. And I don't know, what were you thinking then? Okay, we can actually get them, or were you thinking, oh no, that was our chance?
There was a lull, and then pressure starting to build, and the optimism starts coming back a little bit. And you know, under Fergie,
not with Jock Brown, it wasn't.
He wasn't 11, to be fair to Jock. I mean, we were used to seeing these great surges, like you saw from Fergie's Man United.
Yeah.
Surges of energy and surges of pressure always was from his teams. And Aberdeen managed to really start building something before half time and had Bayern pinned back. So there was a feeling then that things were returning to slightly in Aberdeen's favour again.
Well, they eventually get the equaliser.
So 6 minutes before half time, lovely little ball inside the fullback for McGee.
Yeah.
Lofted to the back post. Black comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah. The keeper sort of has misjudged the flight of the cross.
And the keeper has a great game, but that's the one mistake he makes.
Müller, the keeper, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Black sort of heads it back across goal where it's blocked by Gruber, and then Simpson coming in smashes it into the empty net.
He was allowed to smash it. The defender could have had that away.
Yeah,
I think he could have swung at it first time, maybe. I don't know, but
it was actually I looked at Fergie's two of Fergie's autobiographies. I don't know how many he's actually written now, but I looked at both of them, and there's definitely one of them where he describes it as, you know, won a tackle on the goal line.
Yeah,
isn't quite how it is, but I think you're right. I think he definitely wanted it more.
I'd say so.
The parlance of the time.
Yeah, I mean, Simi Neil Simpson, he epitomised what Aberdeen were, I guess, because he was a local lad. Fresh out of school, straight into the team. It was a team built around, you know, Millen, McLeish, Strachan, they were the sort of stars, really. But I guess the heart and soul were the four kids, the four local kids. Eric Black, who came from just up the coast. John Hewitt, an Aberdeen lad who, you know, had offers from Liverpool and Man United, but signed for Aberdeen at 15. I remember the back page of the local paper was a 15-year-old, you know, signed for us. Neil Cooper, who was born in India but was basically an Aberdeen lad, and Neil Simpson, and that kind of rangy determination and you know, perhaps intimidated the German defender. That was just the force of desire and physicality that sort of ran through that team, probably thanks to those four kids as much as anything else.
So yeah, at 1-1 at half time, and then a bit of optimism creeping in. And then a fabulous goal.
It's a ridiculous goal.
Should have been disallowed. I mean, talk about disallowed. It's too good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's too good.
So Bayern have sprung a slight tactical surprise by playing Hans Flügler, who was a left back, but he's quite a tall player. Yep. And they played him on the left wing rather than the left back. I guess the idea being he'd get a Kennedy in the air.
Yeah.
And Kennedy ends up being taken off, but shortly before he's taken off for 66 minutes, there's 5 minutes before this, there's a cross from the right. Aberdeen seemed to have everything right. I mean, McLeish wins the header, heads are clear. And this left back turned left winger running onto it, sort of the corner of the box. And just hits the most technically perfect left footed volley, sort of waist high.
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, it feels a very early 80s strike of a ball. His body shape is early 80s. It's all an early 80s version of Zidane's goal against Bayer Leverkusen. Yes.
Yeah.
It's Roy of the Rovers stuff, I'd say.
Yeah.
And he executes like a trailing.
I have to say, I'm not sure if I were Jim Leighton, I'm not sure I'd want to see it from behind the goal.
Yeah.
It might
we're not afforded
there,
the cameras that we are now, but I wonder, I don't suppose you know Johnny if you've ever spoken to him, but would Jim Leighton, would he have been
no.
No, that's a bit ridiculous.
I mean, to be fair,
things were to happen to Jim Leighton.
I think we can all agree.
Yeah.
To be fair to him, he wouldn't have been expecting a shot to be struck that clearly cleanly at that moment.
Well, I suppose that shows you how good the goal was. Because on the keeper, it would have been his favoured post if someone was going to have a shot at goal. And yet it just sort of scuds past
suppose
him
he's
into
been,
the corner.
Been tracking across goal, following the cross. Maybe he's not quite set for it. But then, it's a beautiful strike.
Jim was known as a good shot stopper.
He was a good keeper, like.
Was, you know, at that point. And I mean, the thing about it was Flügler just hits it like a training exercise. It's so kind of casually brilliant and dismissively good that you know, even more than the Augenthaler goal, that just took the wind out of the stadium sails. That at that point, where you just thought, okay, these lot are too good.
And that's certainly how Jock Brown regarded it on commentary.
Yeah.
Jock Brown's a commentator who I've certainly developed a fascination by doing this podcast. But he's somehow quite often wrong, but strangely brilliant while being quite often wrong.
Well, there's an odd. I mean, this is probably scope for some kind of book in this from some, you know. But
I'm looking for ideas. So.
Yeah. Well, or at least a Blizzard article.
Yeah, that's a Blizzard article, possibly. But there was a history at the time of school teachers becoming football people in Scotland that had immense influence over Scottish football at the time. And you know, you had Craig Brown and Andy Roxburgh going into the national setup. We had Archie McPherson and Jock Brown, school teachers who you know became the two leading commentators. And there's something a little bit headmasterly about
There is, absolutely.
Definitely,
I think that's generally the tone of commentary at the time.
Oh, yeah, they're teaching you.
You think Barry Davis is very sort of schoolmasterly?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, that's I didn't realise that about Jock Brown, but I would have probably been able to guess it, I think.
He then suddenly will use a very schoolteachery term. Let's get on to that.
Let's move on to that straight away. So
16 minutes later, 13 minutes to go, Aberdeen need two to not lose. Two to win, but also two to not lose. Did you want to describe what
happens? Quick, couple of big tactical changes. We talk about Flügler. So, you know, Ferguson, he takes Stuart Kennedy off and everyone thinks the striker's going to come on. Instead, he puts John McMaster on to play left back. You know, as I say, McMaster's this great technician, but he's essentially just swapped his fullback, sent on a left back when you're chasing the game. So that seemed odd.
Did Rugvi not swap sides?
Rugvi goes over to basically scare the life out of Flügler.
Right.
And McMaster goes on the left. And basically, Bayern was so well set at the time that Aberdeen needed the most creative player in the park, which was probably McMaster, and he
Cooper dropped back as well, didn't he?
Cooper became a holding player, or
sort of freed up McMaster a bit.
Yeah, and McMaster's job was just to try and ping, you know, kind of long passes from where he could, and that did start to change the game, and Flügler was quelled a little bit, and then John Hewitt comes on a couple of minutes before this free kick, which will never be forgotten.
No. Well, Aberdeen win a free kick sort of on the corner.
It's on the right side of the box, look at it.
A crossable position, we would say.
Yeah, and you know, the classic thing to do, you send the centre-backs up and you concentrate on getting a really good cross into the box, and that's plainly what...
Yeah. Well, McLeish had nearly scored earlier in the game.
From a similar
thing. Yeah. And then there's an interesting free kick routine involving Gordon Strachan, and who was the other one?
John McMaster.
Oh, sorry, McMaster. Right enough, yeah.
So, I mean, and this history to this routine, but I mean, it went back. Aberdeen went on a mid-season training break to Portugal, and they ended up with sort of rubbish pitch. It was full of sand, so they couldn't do anything else except practice set pieces. And Strachan came up with this free kick routine, at that time, and it was, he called it the fuck up routine. And his words to McMaster was Spammer, which was McMaster's nickname, but Spammer, we're fucking this one up. So that, basically what it involved was McMaster and Strachan, left foot and right foot, are standing over the ball, both of them walking back at the same time, and then both of them dummying the free kick at the same time, as if, you know, one expected the other one to take.
And they sort of, yeah, as if they're getting each other's way.
As if they misunderstood and they've gotten each other's way. Now, we'd seen it happening. They tried it in a corner kick in Scotland, and the SFA had actually banned them from doing it at corners. I'd seen it against other Scottish opponents, and it kind of sowed a bit of confusion, but hadn't really led to anything. And by the time they tried it against Bayern, I mean, we knew in the stand, when you saw them walk back, you kind of had a sense. And you were actually going, oh no, not that, no, not this one. This is embarrassing.
Not the fuck up.
We're already being taught a football lesson. You know, we're going to look so tin pot. Silly little free kick, and Bayern will just head it away. But it's executed perfectly. And excuse me, but apparently at the time when they dummy it, they then start this fake argument, and Strachan was literally still swearing at McMaster, like, you know, screaming at him. When he then whips the ball into the box, Bayern are completely rooted. It's like a lovely cross straight onto McLeish's head and a sort of towering header.
To make it
2-2. And the Bayern Munich players could not accept that this was a trick. They couldn't accept that they'd fallen for something as base as this. And apparently in the hotel afterwards, they went back to the Ski and Do Hotel in Aberdeen, which was the best hotel at the time. And so the story goes, we're sat up in the bar, you know, in the small hours, arguing about this. They couldn't have meant it. It was your fault. They couldn't have meant it.
But what was Jock Brown's commentary?
Oh, yeah.
So Jock Brown, who initially sort of, he's surprised by it. And he goes, oh, there'd been a misunderstanding. And then when Strachan puts it in, they score, and then they replay it, and he says, a well-rehearsed piece of tomfoolery, which is one of the great phrases. You do not get that.
Yeah.
A well-rehearsed piece of tomfoolery.
Moments early, though, he says, oh, bit of a mistake, a bit of a mix-up there. And then moments after that, he goes, well, of course, if you thought that they were, I knew very well that they, hang on, Jock. I'm pretty sure, you know, everyone else in the stadium he's making out was fooled by this as well. Yeah. Whereas, as you say, Aberdeen fans are thinking, oh, we know what's going on here.
And that's the headmaster. I'm just changing the answer, and I'm right. But it's not STV's finest 40 seconds of broadcasting, apart from that golden line, because then what happens is that the camera then basically misses the denouement.
All you see is a Black's header, Müller pushes it out, and Hewitt sticks it between Müller's legs as he tries to get back to his feet.
I mean, for the Dons fan connoisseur, you can actually take a lot of pleasure in watching what happens, because the camera focuses on McLeish, and they're talking, this is his second goal of the season or whatever it is. And McLeish, you can see that McLeish's eye is caught by something, and he starts looking up towards the box. He's got this stare that becomes more expectant. And I've watched this so many times, just enjoying the emotions changing on McLeish's face as he's watching what's going to be a goal unfold. What is missed and wasn't captured for posterity is John McMaster's crossfield ball. Mm. He did exactly what Ferguson had sent him on to do.
So it's a cross from the left wing. I mean, I genuinely don't know. Yeah. You've only seen the TV. So it's a cross from the left wing.
It's a beautiful long diagonal cross from the left wing, pretty much after regaining possession from the kickoff. And Bayern, their heads are still scrambled, and McMaster just spears this fabulous ball onto Eric Black, who you know, best header of the ball I've ever seen. Rises like a salmon. Wonderful header. Manfred Müller, who has had a very, very good game, actually, it's an incredible save. You know, he was denied one of the great saves, really, by Hewitt following up. But even then, it's so improbable, because the ball lands and Hewitt actually slips in the mud and kind of gets this kind of nasty little touch with the toe of his left foot, and it goes through Müller's legs, which Hewitt afterwards admitted it was a complete accident. You know, didn't mean to do that.
And, would I be harsh in saying it? Because Manfred Müller, earlier on in the game, makes a fabulous save from
a black header.
Clutches it on the line from a black header.
I mean, it's a phenomenal save.
It's a phenomenal save. I mean, just the fact he holds it as well. It would be a very good save if he pushed it away.
Absolutely. But he held on to this ball. It was a close-range header. Would it be harsh to say on that third Aberdeen goal, he sort of tries to catch it again? Yeah. if he push a modern day goalkeeper would probably push that over the bar, push it away, and it's away from danger.
But you see, I think this is part of the thing about the shape of goalkeepers. I think modern goalkeepers are just bigger. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they spend much more time in the gym, so they have greater forearm strength, greater wrist strength, and so that sort of flick away with the wrist will go further. Mm. And maybe the balls are different. I don't know, but. That sort of goal feels like it used to happen quite a lot, and now it just doesn't happen. Mm.
The spring's not the same either, is it?
Yeah.
He doesn't spring like a modern goalie. He kind of like jumps straight up and back down again. But within the, you know, and he's not Bayern's regular goalkeeper, as well, I have to say. It should have been Jean-Marie Pfaff in goal, and he was injured. But I think he actually pulls off a really good save.
No, it is a good save. It's just sort of its time.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
And the extraordinary thing, I mean, I don't want to sort of refer one of Aberdeen's great moments to something that subsequently happened, but the idea that a Ferguson team, 16 years later, would stiff Bayern Munich again with two implausible goals from crosses into the box in the space of a minute.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. It's ludicrous, isn't it? It's absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, and what was... It's funny when you say, because obviously Bayern Munich, those two goals, great quality, nearly dampened Aberdeen. Yet
They're proper goals, not these messy Scottish goals.
But the free kick routine, it did feel like they'd properly mugged them off.
They did.
And when Ferguson, the final whistle goes and scenes of celebration, the fans are on the pitch and all that, the way Ferguson kind of jogs or sort of runs.
Yeah, what's that back? He just sprints to the tunnel, doesn't he? Yeah, no sort of thought of kind of savouring the moment or...
But I feel like Ferguson, I almost feel like he's smiling and laughing as he's running off.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Mourinho. It's almost like a Mourinho run down the touchline.
It is.
Is it because of the invasions? Is that why he does that, to get out of the way?
You can see the pitch invasions coming.
Yeah,
but with Ferguson though, you'd probably think for him, he can't be seen celebrating that. You've got a semi-final and the final.
No.
And so to me, that is like. There's almost classic Ferguson. He's running down the touchline, laughing to himself, going, "We have just mugged you off, Bayern. Thank you very much. But if you think I'm going to now get caught up in the celebration, I will wait until we've got the trophy."
Were you on the pitch, Johnny?
Oh no, God! I mean, my dad wouldn't let me. Probably the only pitch invasion ever at Pittodrie as well, because it's not that type of stadium.
Well, it was all seater, wasn't it? So
yeah, first all seater, all covered. Yeah. But what I do remember as a kid was, I mean, as I say, Aberdonians are not known for being tactile. I mean, I still, when I see my dad even now, we kind of do a very, very kind of comedy hug, you know, and reference the fact that we're doing a hug, you know, because it's so unnatural, much more comfortable in the days you could just nod at each other, and you can't do that anymore. But, in the 80s, Aberdonians were Aberdonians, and there were just was unheard of what happened that night. You were kind of hugging the people next to you. You were, as a kid, sort of people ruffling your hair, strangers were...
I can see why that doesn't happen anymore.
No, I cheated on
for a while, mate. But I just remember the city suddenly felt exotic. Even that 15 minutes in the South Stand where I was just this kind of atmosphere that you'd associate maybe more with the Celtic fans or the Rangers fans. When you saw them come to town, the kind of stupid emotional Ouija's when they turned up, you know. But here was us as Aberdonians actually letting go just a little bit and you know, the songs were pretty basic. I mean, we had Here We Go, Bouncy, 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 Aberdeen. I mean, pretty like one word or two word songs. But that night just felt like, you know, incredible.
It all came together.
Celebration, yeah.
And if beating Bayern wasn't big enough, Real Madrid in the final.
Yeah.
What a story.
And that was in a way it was a rehearsal for Real Madrid, because, you know, Fergie pulled off some of the very same tricks in terms of talking up Real Madrid and how great they were. And Jock Steen had told him this sort of stunt to pull, where, you know, he said, go and make Di Stefano, who was the Real Madrid manager, go and make Di Stefano feel important. So Fergie got a fine bottle of whiskey and presented it to him and, you know, kind of made out as if he was just honoured to be in the same dugout area as Di Stefano. And again, you know, Aberdeen were much more convincing in the game. They were pretty much in control of that Cup Winners' Cup final. But there was a similar vibe, you know, playing one of the greats, allowing themselves to be underestimated, and of course the dynamic of John Hewitt scoring at the death from a cross to win the game, and an amazing sort of, I guess, 8 weeks in the life of a 12-year-old. I mean, at that time, I just thought Aberdeen were one of the best club sides in the world, and we're going to win the European Cup next, and goodness knows where this dominance will end. And my dad would just laugh at me. Son, just enjoy it. Just enjoy it.
Aberdonian hugs all round, eh? Well, there we are, Johnny. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for talking us through that one. And thank you for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. For more stories like that, do check out the Blizzard website. Jonathan, where can they find that?
TheBlizzard.co.uk.
Easy peasy. And of course, don't forget, on Football Ramble Daily, we're Monday to Saturday here. So subscribe to make sure you never miss a show. We'll see you next time.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.